Welcome to I'm Listening here on KXL 109, 1450 and NHTalkRadio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program as we come to you from inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street Studio. I'm Listening presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health, caring for the behavioral health of the community. For more information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. Riverbend wants you to know that treatment works. Really good edition of the show coming your way today as we're going to talk about the Doorways program and its approach to combating the opioid epidemic here in the Granite State. And also, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we're going to preview that and some of the programs that Riverbend is pushing forth in regards to May. As Peter Evers, the CEO of Riverbend, joins us on the program as always. Peter, how are you?
Good, thanks, Chris. How are you doing?
Good to see you. And Representative Annie Custer is going to join us on the show today as she is touring Riverbend, toured Riverbend as we tape this show on Wednesday. I'm going to stop by to discuss the Doorways program and also to get an update on what's taking place. So let's get an update on what's taking place from you and what you feel in regards to the implementation of this program.
Yeah, this is a program that's been around now for about 3 months, 3.5 months, actually. We started on January the 1st. And we've spoken about it on the program before, Chris, but this is really an effort to link people who are struggling with the disease of addictions, primarily opioid use disorder, but you know any drug addiction or alcohol addiction is people are welcome. But the idea really is to have somewhere where people can walk in, say that they have a problem, be assessed, be cared for, and then referred to a level of care that's appropriate for them, whether that be residential care or intensive outpatient programs or being hooked up to Alcoholics Anonymous or one of those groups. So really networking to find what services are out there for people. And if there is a wait list for those services, to hold them and be with them and have and see them every day and make contact with them just to make sure that we bridge them to the care that they need.
How is this different than what was being done pre-January 1st?
So this is a state that has not paid a great deal attention to the disease of addiction. As we know, and we've spoken about on this program before, there wasn't a Medicaid benefit for this before 2015, which is extraordinary. And we're paying for that in some ways in terms of the number of overdose deaths that we have in the state. So if something had to happen, something had to happen that made sure that people weren't left hanging out there. So before the hub, or should I say the doorways, which, by the way, there are nine of the doorways that cover the whole state, and Merrimack County is covered by Concord Hospital and Riverbend, and the actual doorway is at 40 Pleasant Street at Riverbend. The idea really was to say, what happened before was that people would call and say, I need help, which is a brave thing to do because of the stigma that's associated with addiction. And oftentimes we would assess somebody or meet with them and say, yeah, okay, well, that's great that you're asking for help, but we can't help you for 3 or 4 weeks. So, you know, you're going to have to go away and you're going to have to manage your addiction before you come back. And guess what happens under those circumstances? People go back to, especially when you think about people having a physical addiction to things, people have to go back to use, especially with alcohol, because you can actually die if you just stop drinking.
Right.
So this is really about following those people, supporting them, and making sure that they get to the level of care without just saying, good luck, we'll see you in 3 weeks, because we're not going to see you in 3 weeks if we don't follow you.
Is the detoxification aspect of alcohol that you're describing, is that also the case with drug addiction as well, or can you just stop cold turkey?
Well, you can, but you can be seriously ill. And of course, if you have accompanying medical conditions, you know, the withdrawal from an opioid can kill you as well, but it would be the accompanying disease that sort of killed you. More and more people are getting outpatient withdrawal protocols for opioids, mm-hmm. Which is, of course, as we've spoken about before here, it's called Suboxone or buprenorphine, and now there are injectable versions of that. So it's quite possible for somebody to go from being quite addicted to an opioid to be on a substitute for that, which is Suboxone, which is a blocker, and be back in work within a week or two. So two different types of addiction. One lethal if you just stop cold turkey and you're really addicted to alcohol, and the other is a process of recovery that can be done on an outpatient basis.
Is payment for doorways almost exclusively Medicaid, or is there other insurance taken and such?
Yeah, I mean, we would bill insurance companies for the services. There are billing codes. For instance, if it was a Cigna person, then they could have, then we would bill them for the initial assessment. We're really interested in taking down barriers to treatment for people. Mm-hmm. So if people come in and they're uninsured, we're not going to be billing those people for that service, because you do not want to be brave enough to come and say, I need treatment, and then
right.
somebody sends
a
bill.
I was just curious as to the structure of it, not saying that. Yeah. So people are either uninsured or they're on Medicaid, yeah. Or that's generally the type of person that comes in? Or?
Yeah, so of the 80 or so people that we've seen over the last 2 months, there has been a handful of people who have come and had insurance, mm-hmm. Private insurance. Oftentimes those people are underinsured. We don't really talk about the underinsured
yes.
population, which I think with...
haven't met their deductible yet and things
right,
of that nature.
Co-deductibles,
yeah.
Yes, or the donut hole, as they call it. And certainly with the erosion of the Affordable Care Act, which is never perfect, and we've talked right. about that on this show before, but many people are having catastrophic coverage now and mm-hmm. buying the cheapest coverage, or not buying at all, of mm-hmm. course, because there's no incentive to do that. So those folks often come in and there's no way to bill an insurance. It would be directly to them. And we do not want to do that, because we want to encourage people as best we can to come in.
And we're going to talk about this with Congressman Custer in a second here, but... I think one of the challenges that still exists is that the for-profit entities are still the ones that are best known. I mean, you can't go through watching a game on TV without a recovery center popping up. And I understand that from a financial perspective, an incentive on the part of the state or the government to get behind a advertising program, but I think that there should be that incentive, because this lower cost community-based option should be made known to individuals across the board. And I feel like the other entities, I mean, I was just down in Boston the other day, and there's billboards that you go onto the T, and there's advertising for that. And obviously, that's outside of the state of New Hampshire, but they are making a significant footprint here in New Hampshire as well. So, do you feel that that's an important piece as well, or is the Doorways program still in its early stages and can't handle a huge influx of individuals? How do you view that?
Well, it's not a huge program, and I suppose we do worry about being inundated. But if we're inundated, then we can I know there's a workforce shortage in the state, but we would hire more folks. In fact, we're just about to do that now. I believe there should be an advertising campaign. I believe that we should be – and I think there is going to be one. Mm-hmm. I think the state have pledged to do that, and I think that will make a difference. There will be an influx. I think I've told you the story before, but I used to run emergency services in Boston, and we put out of Boston Medical Center, and we put advertisements on the red line, actually, and – we were just absolutely inundated mm-hmm. with calls, which is a good thing, because then we can get people to where they need to be. There absolutely needs to be a statewide doorway campaign that lets people know where to call. It's very simple, as we said before. It's 211, and 211 then put the person in touch with the doorway that's nearest to them, mm-hmm. or actually a doorway of their choosing. And so that is happening quite well. There's a lot of word of mouth as well. We're getting a lot of walk-in traffic. People are saying, I hear that people came to you and they got the help that they need. We're telling these success stories of people who have 35 years worth of addiction who come now for the first first time, who now, a gentleman that we were talking about yesterday, has been 60 or 70 days, you know, in recovery after 30 years of addiction.
Wow.
Which is, you know, those stories are ones that really underline the success of the program, I think.
Yeah, I think that there has to be a more consistent effort in getting to the middle class. And, you know, I am greatly concerned about the family that spends a significant amount of money to try to get rehabilitation for their child because they feel that this is the best option. And perhaps there's a stigma that's associated with the state or government option. And to kind of put on a level and let individuals choose and understand you know, what Doorways is and what the other entities are, and that, you know, there is that people, my concern is people losing all of their money and spending all of their money because their child or themselves are struggling with addiction. And I feel that option needs to be a little more prevalent.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, look, I think we have a very different philosophy from some of these private providers. And you hear horror stories, especially down in Boca Raton, which seems to be a place where these places set up, and a number of them have come up here. But what will happen is that, you know, parents will raid their retirement accounts and then pay ridiculous amounts of money, thousands and thousands of dollars a month to keep their child there. And when they run out of money, they're put on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that business model. Now, I'm not saying that all for-profit providers fall into that category, but you have to be really careful about who you choose and do your homework. And, you know, the hub, the Doorway, we used to call it the hub, is certainly some way where you can have that conversation to find out what's available so that you don't bankrupt the whole family and the family of sort of fighting against that. And I don't think the success rates are any different from those providers who pay who get Medicaid.
Right, and that's either. The key. That's the key point. I mean, what? And this is a conversation we have about healthcare a lot, where individuals don't have, you know, that booking.com where they can look at, okay, opioid addiction, and you put that in, and then five different places pop up, and then there's Doorways, there's this one, and this one, and this one. Yeah. They can look at the cost, they can look at the outcomes, they can read reviews about and make their decision. But instead, what you have now is you listen to the radio, you go online, you watch TV. And those are the entities that are there. So you think that those might be your only options. And, you know, it's one of the problems that we have in healthcare. I feel that it's more prevalent in this particular aspect of healthcare than any other, the addiction industry.
It is. And, you know, I was thinking about that because we had a presentation the other day about this thing called Open Beds, which is actually trying to do that. But, you know, as you said that, I realized the Open Beds concept is a little bit like Open Table, where you book a restaurant. But there aren't any reviews on there that just says this is somewhere where the resource could be. And I think you're absolutely right. I think there should be so much more transparency in healthcare overall. And again, it's another topic that we've tackled. There is so much demystifying of the system that needs to be done. And as long as people are talking about it and asking, I think we were talking about people that dispute their bills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're usually successful. People who actually say, I'm not paying this. This is ridiculous. I'm not paying $10,000 for an aspirin. Or whatever it was. I think it was the one that we talked about before was somebody who had a shot for a bite that they'd had for an animal that cost $25,000 in an emergency room. We have to be able to push back against that. And there's the stigma of addiction that lays on top of that as well. Like asking for help, being open about that is difficult for people to do.
That is Peter Evers, CEO of Riverbend Community Mental Health, joining us here on I'm Listening on KXL. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Riverbend very involved with that. Tell us what you guys are planning.
Yeah, it's going to be an absolute extravaganza. Our development folks have been working really hard, not just with Riverbend, but with community partners like the Children's Health Behavioral Health Collaborative, like the National Alliance for Mental Illness, have all got together and said, let's put on events throughout the month that actually celebrate mental health. And so we're actually having on the 1st of May in the morning, we're having a State House launch outside the State House, so hopefully the weather will be nice, where we're having a rally just to raise awareness about children's mental health and mental health overall. We're also having a series of lunch and learns, and that's going to be at the Center for Health Promotion. And the dates for that will be every Tuesday throughout the month at lunchtime, where people come and learn issues like calming the body and clearing the mind. So, Chris, you might want to think about that. and brain pathways and why the brain works like it does and how music can help with that. We're also having the Guardian of the Gate on Thursday the 9th, which is Kevin Briggs, that people may know. He is the cop that used to have the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco mm-hmm. as his beat, and certainly learned a lot about mental illness and suicidality, and was able to talk a number of people off the ledge, as it were. And he's an incredible motivational speaker. And then we're having This Is My Brave, which I think is a signature event on the 23rd, which is... the Moth Radio Hour, which people may know, which is on National Public Radio, is when people come and tell stories. They just tell stories unscripted about incidents in their lives. And This Is My Brave is a take on that, where people tell their stories of hope and recovery and mental illness. So a huge agenda for the month. It's very ambitious, but really the idea is just to push the idea of mental health as opposed to mental illness and how to get there, and look at some specific populations like the LGBTQ plus community. We're actually having a book reading of a book called This Is How It Always Is, which is about a family dealing with transgender issues and depression that comes with that. So a lot of stuff going on.
I think that those are the last two topics you brought up there are really, really interesting, and ones we should probably explore on future shows. You know, what is it to be LGBTQ, and how does that affect your mental health? You know, the fact that religious organizations look at you a certain way, that for many, many years, individuals had to hide who they were, and still do hide who they are. Mm-hmm. Also, what is it like to be a minority? And a minority, whether it's here in New Hampshire mm-hmm. or in other communities, and what is the mental health that plays on that, economics, and so I think that's, you know, the individuals a lot of times will not necessarily think about what their lives are and how mental health plays into it, because it's what they're used to. It's what they live, and not necessarily think about the detrimental impacts, you know, that occur as a result of discrimination or, you know, things of that nature.
Yeah. I mean, I think traveling through the world as a person who is gay is just a very different experience. And, you know, it's funny because there has been more social change in that issue over the last 10 years than any issue ever, I think, in terms of, you think about nowadays, Americans are 68% okay with gay marriage, right? Whereas 10 years ago, I think 7% of the population.
Yeah, civil unions were as far as President Obama and others would go, right. Because they didn't think that's where the public was at that point. And there's been this change. And, you know, in a lot of movements, you can point to specific moments in time where things happened and things changed. And generally, it takes a very long period of time for that change to occur, particularly in regards to the civil rights movement. But, yeah, the societal changes and thought processes in regards to LGBTQ, which obviously has been great in my view, because we are, in my view, a nation of equality. Yeah. But it's been quick, and there has not been, you know, any key moments like, say, the Civil Rights Movement, yeah. that at least appear at the forefront.
Yeah, although I do think, I really do think that the idea of marriage allowed straight America to understand the union of gay couples in a way that they have lived. So I think that, I honestly think that's made a difference. Mm-hmm. I also think millennials, thank God for millennials, they just have a totally different idea about gender fluidity and all of those issues. And so it's not a big issue anymore. You constantly hear stories about brothers who come out to brothers and they say, yeah, and what's the big deal about that? That's sort of the language nowadays, as opposed to my generation, which is, my father would say to me, no son of mine's going to be a gay, who would use another word for that. But we've moved a long way. But there's still issues of depression in that cohort of people that are way higher than with the straight population. And to raise that, Chris, is a great point. And in fact, we are having the, we're concentrating on those issues of gender identity because we know that the prevalence of mental illness in that population is high.
And why do you feel that is specifically? Is it because of the, and you mentioned mental illness, not just mental health. Why do you feel that there is a greater amount of mental illness with that particular?
Well, I think they still struggle because they are not the dominant paradigm. Mm-hmm. They're a minority, and there is still hatred out there. You don't actually have to go very far to find hatred in this climate at the moment, and that might be across generations. So you have feelings that you understand perfectly because that's who you are, that are not accepted wholly by the people around you. And that sort of constant sort of identification as somebody that's different is going to have an effect on those people. It's getting better, but it's still an issue of isolation and very high risk of suicide in that population. It's 4 or 5 times what it is with teenagers who are straight. So we just have to pay attention to that.
I think it's a really key point, and I think we should spend obviously some time on that in future shows discussing. That is Peter Evers. He's the CEO of Riverbend Community Mental Health. This is I'm Listening here on KXL, which is presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. Treatment works. More information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. When we return, we're joined by Congresswoman Annie Custer as we discuss her tour of the Doorways program and get her thoughts on where things are at in regards to the addiction crisis and opioid epidemic here in the Granite State. We'll come back with more on I'm Listening after this. This is I'm Listening here on KXL 1-9, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. For more information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. We're inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio, and we're honored to be joined on the program right now by Congresswoman Annie Custer, who just met with Peter, as well as some reporters, and the Health and Human Services Commissioner, Jeff Myers, to discuss the Doorways program. And great to see you.
Great to be with you, Chris. And it was a fascinating meeting. I really appreciate it, Peter. Thanks for having us in.
So what are the things that you're looking for, particularly in regards to replicating what we're doing here in New Hampshire on a national level from your position in Congress?
Sure. So let me just briefly step back for your listeners. This is an issue, the opioid epidemic, that I've now been working on for about 6 years, working to create a bipartisan, we call it a task force, but it's a group of over 100 members working together to bring solutions to communities all across the country. And we were able to pass the legislation to get the funding to communities, including to states like New Hampshire that have been so hard hit. And now we're going around visiting all of these sites to determine what are the best practices, what are the interventions that are actually making a difference in people's lives, mm-hmm. getting them access to treatment, and that long-term recovery piece that I think had been overlooked early on, and helping people get back on track so they can get back to their work and their families and their communities and be productive members of our society. And that's what we're looking for. And I had a great day at Riverbend to see how this Doorways model is working to get people access to the services they need.
Well, Congresswoman, I just want to thank you for your continued interest in this part of the world in terms of a disease that we're beginning to describe in terms of a disease model nowadays. We're moving away from the choice thing and behaviors, which I think is really helping. I think from our perspective, and we talked a little bit about this morning, it's about getting out of your comfort zone here. It's about providing services in places where we haven't provided those services before. It's about integrating our services with the medical profession, making sure that we're treating substance use disorder and mental health at the same time, and being very intentional about bringing more people into this conversation, because I think that's how we really address it. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, if we are bringing those folks together and drawing people in, we are beginning to raise the conversation on addiction, and we're encouraging wellness. You know, we always say that recovery is possible for everybody. We begin with that. That hope is essential. We have to have hope. And the arc of that recovery is different for people. So it's up to us to sort of fit into their journey of recovery, because it's their decision to do that. And the more that primary care physicians know that, the more that corrections officers know that, the more that judges know that in our drug court, the better we are at getting that message across, and the more hopeful and supportive we are of those people who are struggling with this disease.
Well, and I think, Peter, talking to your staff this morning, it's about getting past the stigma of substance use disorder. You know, we've had so much judgment around addiction for years and years. And I think understanding that there are people with the chronic disease that we consider alcoholism or substance use disorder or opioid addiction that are functioning in our society, having gotten treatment, having been through long-term recovery, living in recovery, and functioning at a very, very high level. And that's what I want everyone to know. You know, we don't say to a diabetic, we can't treat you, you just ate cake. We say that's a very difficult disease. How can we help you and your family and support you, because you ought not to eat cake for the rest of your life? And I think that's the approach that our medical professionals, our healthcare, wherever you access, and now that we know that Riverbend at 40 Pleasant Street can be your point of access, can be your doorway to open up that pathway to recovery, and that you'll get all of the services that you need in one place. They'll be able to, you won't get all the services there, but they'll be able to connect you with the mental health services, the substance use treatment. If you need housing, if you need transportation, if you need childcare, there's so many hurdles to people getting over this and getting into recovery.
I think a lot of times one of the challenges that we have in our society as a whole, and in particular in this aspect, is the why, and asking why. Why is the individual using drugs? And looking beyond just treating the drug addiction issue and figuring out, you know, what is the reason and rationale that they're using it. Is it an economic issue? Is it a mental health issue? And the opioid epidemic is one that is an all-encompassing one and is not focused specifically on an individual using drugs. They're doing so for a reason. And there were a number of fascinating things that you were just discussing. And I want to get to, in particular, Medicaid and the fact that individuals who are incarcerated do not receive Medicaid and lose their coverage once they are incarcerated. And that then becomes a huge burden on the state to pay for their health treatment. And we're going to get to that in a second. But one of the key aspects, I think, of making sure that the Doorways model is successful in New Hampshire is promoting it more. And I'm concerned about the amount of dollars that are behind the for-profit entities. And you hear them advertised and see them advertised consistently. You watch cable TV, they pop up. It was down in Boston, which obviously is not New Hampshire, but you see the ads on the T, and also large ads as well along I-93. And individuals, particularly in the middle class, will see this and feel that these are the options that they have to pursue and not know about options like Doorways, which is available and has really good success rates. And the other for-profit entities, there's a lot of question about what their success rates are, and we know what the costs are. So to me, I feel that there still has to be an emphasis, and I'm not sure if a grant is available for this or if it's something that can be done from a congressional level, to allow for individuals to be more aware that treatment is available here in your community, here in New Hampshire, no matter where you live. And the for-profit entities, which is in your mind and consciousness because of the amount of money that's behind their advertising campaigns, is not necessarily the best option for you.
Well, I totally agree. And I think that's what's important about a show like this, to be able to get the word out. Riverbend is a not-for-profit organization, mm-hmm. part of the Concord Hospital regional organization. And no one's taking a profit off of your recovery. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important for people and for families. These are difficult decisions to make. What's the best place? And what the Doorways option is all about is to walk through that doorway. And again, I'm going to say 40 Pleasant Street because I want people in the Concord region to know this is at Riverbend. Walk through that doorway and you will hear all of your options. And one of the most important pieces that they can help you do is to figure out how to pay for your treatment and mm-hmm. recovery. Are you eligible for Medicaid expansion? Many people don't realize that they are eligible for coverage. They assume they cannot afford to get the type of mental health treatment or substance use treatment that they need. But the reality is so many people have been informed of their options. They help them with the paperwork to get that mm-hmm. taken care of. They can check if you do happen to have insurance, will your insurance cover it? What's the coverage available? Mm-hmm. And because we have parity for mental health treatment, for substance use treatment, your insurance will cover it, and you should get that help that you need. So,
and I feel there's still stigma that's associated, and Peter can address this, with going into recovery. You either think of recovery as a place, you know, for rich rock stars to go and dry out on an island somewhere, or a place that's quote unquote for junkies. Mm-hmm. And so, Peter, how do you hit people who are struggling with this in the middle class and think the treatment is either too expensive or is not for them?
Yeah, you know, it's a real issue. And again, it goes to that issue that the Congresswoman was talking about. How do we address the stigma? How do we normalize conversations around this disease? And that's what we're trying to do in the state, actually. The Change Direction campaign with John Broderick that Riverbend started a few years ago was exactly to do that. Tell a story about a disease. Tell a story about recovery. Tell a story and ask people in the room who is not afflicted by a behavioral health condition. And it is unusual for a human being to go through the whole lifespan without having emotional distress or perhaps some kind of mental illness.
Now or trauma. And mm-hmm. you asked how people get into mm-hmm. this. And the more research that we see and the more anecdotal stories as I go around the state talking to people, you have people with high levels of anxiety. You have people with depression. You have people with other types of mental illness that we might recognize. But you also have a very high level of trauma.
Yeah.
I've talked to so many people that are victims of sexual assault in their childhood. Mm-hmm. They might be victims of domestic violence. One thing in particular is women who have been sexually assaulted in the workplace, mm-hmm. in the military, by a family member. Men, this is an issue that we really don't talk about mm-hmm. enough in our society. Young men in their childhood that were sexually assaulted, the behavior at that point in time was, oh, boys will be boys. Nobody was saying that's totally inappropriate. Mm-hmm. That's a breach of your autonomy, of your safety. Families didn't want to talk about it. And I think the more that people recognize, and the other thing about the opioid epidemic that I feel is very different in terms of people's impressions, so many people are falling into the substance use disorder through legitimate prescriptions
right.
from their healthcare provider. High doses of OxyContin, right. oxycodone, Percocet from the dentist, from the ER, from the surgeon. And we as a society need to take responsibility for that.
Right.
And to say, you've been wronged, we are here to support you and to help you. And I think it's very appropriate that Concord Hospital, Riverbend, our medical community is stepping up to say, we want to help you. We have erred in our treatment. First, do no wrong is should be our goal.
I think it's, you know, clear that individuals start using drugs because they make them feel good. And it eases the pain that they have, whether it's a physical or an emotional pain. And that realistic discussion is where everything needs to start. An individual doesn't use drugs because there's something wrong with them. They use drugs because they, like many other individuals, are looking to ease the pain that has occurred in the course of their lives. And in order to stop individuals from using drugs, which can have more detrimental impacts than the pain that they're currently suffering, there has to be a discussion of ways to offset and the preventative aspect of things. Okay. What can individual do that will help them to ease their pain instead of using drugs? And people talk about yoga, talk about mindfulness.
Acupuncture has been very helpful to deal with physical pain. Yeah. There are alternatives. I think people need to be much more proactive with their physician.
Yes.
If they're going to have surgery, have a conversation. Say, you know, I'm too aware of opioid addiction. We have people in our family, or I want an alternative. I want to talk with you about an alternative. And I think, frankly, the medical delivery system needs to catch up with that.
Yeah.
And needs to say, you know, opioid medication is only one alternative. And by the way, I think what's difficult is that many people can use opioid medication for pain, say surgery or car accident or something, and they'll use it for a short period of time, and they may do perfectly well with it. It does alleviate pain, and then they stop, and they never go back to it. Some people, particularly if they're on it for a long period of time, and we don't have all the research we need. Part of the federal funding is going into research, both of alternative pain management, but also trying to understand what is the connection, where, at what point. But we certainly know that a shorter period of time is far preferable to being on this medication for a long period of time. Your chances of becoming addicted and needing have craving this medication goes up dramatically over weeks and months.
That's Congresswoman Annie Custer joining us here for I'm Listening. I'm Chris Ryan along with Peter Evers. We're here inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. I'm Listening, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think the other thing is there are people who have a predisposition to addiction.
Yes.
And we don't talk about that too much. Well, we sort of do, but it's usually a couple of generations back, and there seems to be a statute of limitation with that. Well, my grandfather, you know, and I do it. But you know, people really have to know about their predisposition. It is not unusual. And it happened to me a few years ago when I was very sick. I was given a massive dose of opioids.
Yep.
And nobody asked me or my family.
Yes.
Now, if I'd had a history, that I would be back, you know, to my addiction. So
yep.
It is a question of understanding the brain, understanding yep. the disposition to this disease, and also having a conversation about it.
I had a cough, and the doctor gave me codeine.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it was an opioid until I read the labeling at the end. There was no conversation in regards
to
it.
We have legislation to label, for particularly that reason. This is a tragic story up in Plymouth, New Hampshire, and I can use the name. This family has been extraordinary. Dr. Messenger and his wife, Susan Messenger, has become an incredible advocate, but their son Carl died because he was in recovery. He had just been to a 28-day program. He had come home. He was doing great. He was finished UNH, and he was studying. He wanted to be a dentist. And what happened was he got a cold. They gave him codeine cough syrup. Nobody told him. The physician didn't say. The pharmacist didn't say. He went home and took it, and it has what they call, it will inflict drug-seeking behavior. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, the next phone call was to his old dealer, and he got 100% fentanyl, and the mother came home and found him dead on the bathroom floor. Yeah. And it's a total tragedy.
Yeah.
And nobody along that step ever said this medication can cause that drug-seeking behavior if you have experienced addiction and if you're in recovery.
Believe it or not, we're running out of time already, but I wanted to touch upon, again, what you were talking about with Commissioner Myers in the meeting. And to me, I think that the work you're doing on this aspect of things is something that is really, really important, and we need to look at the state level in addition to the federal level. To me, for far too long, we have looked at prisons and just kind of checked the box and said, oh, yeah, we're just going to give money to that. And that's something that needs to be funded. And there hasn't been a diligence of looking at this and saying, okay, what are the outcomes? And what is it actually like in prison? And how should we go about making sure that we reduce recidivism rates? And you were talking about the fact that something that I didn't know, and I'm sure many people don't know as well, that once an individual has health insurance, that goes away once they're incarcerated.
The day of incarceration.
Right, and the state has to pick up that cost. And you're introducing, I believe, legislation.
Legislation. Yeah. So we have two bills. One is a pilot project that would bring treatment and recovery for both mental health and substance use disorder in-house, so it would be grant funding to determine if this is as successful as we've seen. So it started over in Sullivan County. It's now come to Merrimack County. The gentleman by the name of Ross Cunningham came up with this model to bring the treatment in-house. Mm-hmm. And they have had a dramatic dropping the recidivism rate from the 80th percentile down to the 20th percentile. So we could empty out our prisons from people. And I'm not talking about violent crime. If people, they need to serve time, prison can be a deterrent. But there's so many people in our prison system now who have mental health issues, have substance use issues. They're getting no treatment. And then we all act shocked, absolutely shocked, when they come out and go back to their addiction and back to crime. And we live with incredibly high recidivism rates. So my second bill, once we're able to demonstrate and we have the evidence to demonstrate this to my colleagues, is to bring Medicaid coverage and funding from the federal government to the states to provide this treatment during incarceration. And I expect that we're going to see dramatic reduction in recidivism, people that are going to be able to get into recovery, to get the mental health treatment that they need, to return to their communities and work and families and paying their taxes. And I think it's barbaric right now, frankly, what we're doing. And this is all across the country. From 50 years ago when Medicaid was first created, they carved out people during incarceration.
Yeah, in conclusion on that, I mean, we've talked a lot in this program about the individuals who are incarcerated and the amount of individuals who suffer from mental illness. And it should be said that mental illness is not an excuse for committing a crime. If you've committed a crime, you deserve to be punished as deemed fit by a court. But the fact of the matter is that most individuals are going to leave prison at some point in time. And it's very important that they get treatment and that we figure out a model. And New Hampshire, as we talked about before, is such a nimble state that we can do something like this. Figure out a model where we remove a corrections focus to a recovery and reentry focus.
Right.
And if we do that, I feel like we reduce the costs of prison remarkably and have a significant amount of money to invest in prevention and other aspects of our state.
Absolutely. And my point is, let's keep people from committing the crime in the first place and going to prison. If you look at this, quote, war on drugs and how ineffective it's been, because locking people up without treatment for their underlying addiction is useless. When they come out, they're going to still have diabetes when they come out. They're still going to have their substance use disorder, and they're going to be committing crime to feed that addiction, to feed that habit. And if you look at across the number of people in our state who were perfectly law-abiding people who ended up in jail because they got caught up in this opioid epidemic. They were selling the drugs to feed their own habit. And so many lives have been shattered, so many grandparents raising children. Let's get our state back on track. Let's keep people well and healthy and give them the treatment they need.
The great thing is I think we're beginning to row in the same direction. I think we're getting, this transformational stuff you're doing with Medicaid is such a big piece of it. We're training clinicians to accept that this is a disease. We're promoting wellness. You know, we're actually giving people other opportunities. I'm very optimistic that we're rowing in the right direction, but there's an awful long way to row.
Right.
Congresswoman, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely, Chris. Great to be with you. And Peter, thank you for all the work you're doing for our community.
This is I'm Listening here on KXL, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health.